Welcome back to Season 7 of the Real Life Theology Podcast, Moving Towards Disciple-Making Movements, a Renew.org resource where we renew the teachings of Jesus to fuel disciple-making. This is Matthew Croson, and in today's episode, Paul and Jeff talk about practical next steps to shift our culture to launch new churches. In this season, we have talked about disciple-making movements and disciple-making culture, and this episode takes us to the next step. You will be exposed to ideas, testimonies, and challenges of what we as individuals and as churches can do moving forward.
Okay, friends, I am going to ask for your attention as we shift into moving from the inspiration and sort of the challenge of the sobering reality to practical examples of next steps that a church can take. And obviously, we know that all of this starts with us embracing this and living this in our networks and neighborhoods and sphere of influence. But what are some examples of practical next steps a church can take? So I would like to share just a few of those things that we've done, and that'll kind of kick over to Paul and something he's been doing. And then we're going to bring three of you from the audience up on stage to share some practical next steps you've been taking in this pursuit of, and then we're using the words disciple-making movement, but I think there are other words we could use. It is the power of a move of God by the Spirit of God bringing transformation and multiplication, contagion of Jesus, his culture, his glory, his fame, his brilliance everywhere, every crack and crevice. That's the kind of thing we're talking about. Not sometimes even at LifeSpring, we've said, talk about it, but you can't use the words disciple-making. Because sometimes that can just trigger things in people's minds. So one of the things for us at LifeSpring that's been catalytic is experiences like this, getting around people who inspire and challenge and stretch, and especially hearing what God is doing around the world, not just in our little circle of it, and throughout history, and even looking at historical examples. And that, for us, led to the opportunity to get to some exponential conferences. And I'm just going to share just a few things that have been steps we've taken. And I do want to mention that in your digital workbook, I chronicled as many of them as I could think of. There's a link in there to our journey to move towards missional multiplication. On some days, I feel like we're still just starting to wake up. But it has been an exciting journey, and we're excited to keep taking steps heading in that direction. I do believe we are turning what feels like a Titanic, but we can also simultaneously deploy lifeboats, and we'll be talking more about that tonight. We decided to rewrite our vision and our mission and our strategy in light of our commitment to Jesus-style disciple-making. And we formalized the commitment. God gave us the vision. We heard his call. We formalized it in writing and communicating with the congregation, a new mission, vision, strategy statement. We started some congregational mantras in explaining that the church is not a building. The church is not a place you go on Sunday morning. The building is people. So we would say, we don't go to church. And just little mantras like that are starting to shape and form the culture. And we still do it. We still sometimes, and Josh, even you did it today, said something, I'll see you at the church. I almost corrected you. I was like, we don't say, that's like a no-no. We kind of slap each other's wrists a little bit. My kids will correct me. I'm going to head down to the church. He's like, is there an assembly today? we tried to and are continuing to seek to align our leaders with our language and our definitions of a disciple. And that was just critical for us. We're not going to tell you what you have to, but get aligned. Have everybody take out a note card and say, what is a disciple? Give a definition and a description and then see, do they match? And if they don't, hammer out one that you can all rally around that is obviously based on Jesus and what it means to be an apprentice of him. We rewrote our staff ministry descriptions. Every staff ministry description was rewritten with the number one priority of making disciples. And they know what that means. It wasn't ethereal. It was very concrete. And it was laid out. We started talking about this in our elders and our board of elders. And we just said, we need to be the ones leading the way. And while we feel like we're just the infants getting started in this, let's learn how to walk together. And let's cheer each other on. And so we just, in our monthly shepherds meeting, just said, let's just do, how's it going making disciples? It's just a simple question we're just going to add to every monthly meeting. We started doing stuff like that. We looked at our metrics and our scorecard, and we said, we need to rewrite this. And so we looked at, instead of counting how many people we baptize, why don't we count how many people we baptize, how many people were baptized by a discipler, not one of the paid staff. And it was such a subtle shift, but it was huge. I remember one year, we're like, yes, our best metric ever. We have one third generation, a disciple who made a disciple who made a disciple. And so we just started counting that stuff. And now we're shifting from not just the lag metrics, that's measuring the stuff that happens because of the stuff you do, to say, well, let's measure the stuff we do. Let's measure how many of our leaders we train to be disciple makers. And so we're counting that, and we're saying we're wanting to see that needle, that dial turn in that direction. We made a formal decision to embrace a leadership structure that was more decentralized. While my title is the senior pastor, I do not lead staff meetings. We take turns and we rotate leadership. I am not the teaching pastor. We have a teaching team. We made a formal shift to say weekend services are not game time, they're locker room. The week is game time, and just these kinds of things, and we'll talk about that. We started trying to harvest and share stories. So one of the things we do in every staff meeting is say, what stories do we know of multiplication, of disciple making? And we write them down, and then when we're looking, we need to share more testimonies. And this is one we know we need to do a better job of harvesting and sharing these stories. I'm gonna stop there. Paul, come on up. Renew has been huge and instrumental for us. Renew had a opportunity to be in a hybrid missional, attractional churches implementing disciple-making movement principles or something like that that you were leading. So I was getting a chance to hear about other churches doing these kinds of things. You've been leading it. What are incremental next steps you've been hearing churches take to move towards disciple-making movement?
Yeah, so I'll share just one that we implemented where I was during the time of this incubator or leading into that time. And you'll see, I think I've got slides for this. If not, I'll just kind of walk you through it and it'll make sense. Real quick, let me give you just some background. So I was at a church for 8 years up until just a couple of months ago, where we had been working to make the transition from being really a purely attractional church, and I'll talk about that more in the session this evening, so if you'll be here, you'll hear a little bit more about that, but a purely attractional kind of come and see what we do here in this space, and everything that happens that really matters happens in this space kind of church. So when I came to that church a little more than 8 years ago, that's really what the church looked like. Now, that's not putting down that church, because all churches in our area just north of Atlanta pretty much looked like that. That's how we operated. And so if you were doing church well, it was because you were really attracting a whole lot of people. And as Todd was talking about, you were adding some of those to your group and you were showing growth, you know, butts, bucks, and baptisms, all those kind of things that you count when you are really at that level three adding stage. And so we became convinced that that was not really living out the mission of Jesus faithfully. That, I mean, we had come up with like a variety or a variation of living out the mission of Jesus faithfully, and we were doing well enough that we had even some success stories to share. But really, we were not living out the Great Commission, right? We had replaced the mission of Jesus with the mission of doing church better than the church down the road. I mean, really, that was our mission. And so we, because of becoming convinced of that, decided we needed to do some things different. Now, we started casting vision for what that different would look like. And what we found is actually about 50 people said, we're not really up for that kind of different. And they went and found a new church. And then what we found is the rest of our folks didn't really change. Like we cast vision as much as we could, but they didn't really change. And so we started even maybe giving the right definitions and some other things, all these things that are really powerful, by the way. And if you don't do these things, probably you're not going to see a change. But we found out it wasn't enough. And so we started thinking, one day I was just praying, God, help us see what the next step that we can take is that will actually help us find traction, because that is what we were missing over and over and over again, was traction. We'd even done some training events. I mean, we called people in and we did training events on, here's how we think you can become a disciple who makes disciples. But what we found is until we brought together a group of people who were so hungry for that next thing that they would actually really take those steps together as a group, And it was the synergy of that group that propelled them forward. We didn't actually see traction start to happen. And I'll explain why. You may be familiar with Todd already talked about the bell curve. And so you saw the picture of the bell curve on the screen behind you. The bell curve is also kind of overlaid the ideas of innovation adoption. Does that make sense? So the bell curve as it relates to innovation adoption, how those things work. And so I'm just going to give you kind of real quick, just a picture that maybe this will paint a picture. Okay. So that's the bell curve as it relates to innovation adoption. Now, I shared this with our incubator group as we were talking about some of the things that made that gave us the most forward motion in our church as we were looking to really shift culture. And here's what we did. So we looked at, so I was praying one day, and for some reason, the image of the bell curve popped in my mind. Now, again, I don't know. I may have been looking at a bell curve the day before, and so it just happened to pop in my mind. Or maybe it was God really working and saying, hey, I've got something here that you need to pay attention to. And so I'm also a professional counselor. My master's in counseling, the little bit that I did of my doctorate degree, was a doctorate in ministry with an emphasis in family therapy. And so I like to think about behavior, human behavior, and even how we sociologically, how human beings behave together as groups in particular, right? And so this actually explains some behavior. So you'll see why this matters in just a second. Go ahead and go to the next slide. You'll see the innovators, that first group to typically do something new, they are the ones that create new ideas, new materials and processes. Then you've got the early adopters who come afterwards, and those folks take those ideas and apply them in real world practice. Then after that, you've got the early majority. They work with new yet proven ideas. I mean, they're new ideas, but they want to see that they actually work, right? So then after that, you have the late majority. They adopt new ideas once fully established. Now, another way of thinking about this, and we're, you know, you can see the laggards there, they adopt new ideas, but only grudgingly. So they're the ones that will grumble and grumble and grumble when you make a change, right? Another way of looking at this is that innovators do this. Innovators do development, early adopters do refinement, early majority does employment, or late majority does acknowledgement. And if you get the laggards to shift, it's with resignment, right? So what I really started thinking about then, and what I went to the staff and I said, you know, our discipleship minister, I said, hey, I think there's a principle here at work that we need to learn. It's a principle that's pretty uniformly true about human behavior, that any change in an organization and a system begins with a really small group of people. Now, that will matter a lot when you'll see some of these next slides as we'll go through, and I promise I'll make this pretty fast. You can actually go to the next slide, but we won't really talk about that. It's just another way of thinking. I was trying to enforce to our group, our incubator group, that really it's this gap between the innovators and early adopters where you really need to double down, because what you're going to do, you're going to cast a vision that really creates expectations. Unfortunately, your expectations may actually be inflated, or the rate at which you believe change may happen may lead you to what Gartner, if you've heard Gartner's hype cycle, actually calls the peak of inflated expectations. So you cast such a compelling vision, good for you, that your folks are saying, okay, what now? And they've got expectations about what's going to happen, nothing happens. Or maybe it's you've got an expectation, in my case, that something is going to happen, nothing's going to happen. Out of that, you'll get a few people that say, okay, to really see systemic change, where you've really got to double down is this chasm between early adopters and early majority. Anyway, that's a whole different thing. All that to say that the truth of change is really managing change is difficult. Next slide on there is that managing change is actually more difficult if you don't understand how difficult it is to manage change, and that's very true. Now, to think about this in a more kind of people-centered terms, we actually found, there's this guy named Simon Wardley who created the PST model, Pioneers, Settlers, Town Planners, and this actually relates better to people. Now, I'm going to leave that up there for just a second, but we're going to move on from that pretty quickly. Go to the next slide and then actually skip to the next one. Some of this doesn't necessarily relate that much to us. Here's what I really want you to see that's really, really important out of this. What we discovered and what we actually, about a year and a half later, read in a book that I wish we would have read a year and a half before, a book by a guy named John Rittner called Positively Irritating. Really good little book that helped us think about navigating change in disciple making or disciple making culture within in a church. And here is what he said: cultural change is diffused, not dumped. Okay, cultural change is diffused, not dumped. Go ahead and go two slides forward, and I'm going to show you what I mean by that. here's what we've been doing is we've been casting this compelling vision. I would stand up on the stage on Sunday mornings and I would preach at our folks about why we needed to change and why what we were doing just wasn't working. It was never going to work. It wasn't going to help us live out the Great Commission. We all needed to change. And so I would preach these messages, and sometimes people even would come and say, that was so good. That was so good. I was so challenged. And then we do nothing about it. All right. I mean, nothing about it. We just rallied around something that sounded really good, and we knew we should do it, but change is difficult, right? Change is not easy. And so what we were trying to do is say, okay, we're going to dump this vision upon the whole organization. That part still needs to happen to some degree, but we believe that the dump was going to produce the change. And what we found is that real change, especially cultural change, in an existing organization is always spread through diffusion, not dump. So where do you gain traction? It is through diffusion that you gain traction. And so what we did for 6 months, we found the people we knew were hungry. They were the people who, when I would preach something, when our discipleship minister or somebody else would preach something from the stage, or when we would have a training, there are the people coming and saying, we want to do this. We want to do this. We just don't really know how to do this. We're really trying. We're giving it our all. We're failing. We're stumbling. And so we said, okay, we're going to bring this group together. And for us, out of about 800 people, if 2.5% is the pioneers or the innovators, that wasn't a really large group to begin with to really see traction happen, right? And so we were overwhelmed by the task ahead of us, actually, until that moment that we said, hey, hold on, big things start small. Or as our friend Shadonke Johnson, who some of you may be familiar with, says, if you want to go fast, start slow, right? If you want to grow big, start small. So start with small. And that principle actually is where we started gaining traction, because what happened was we got that 2.5% together. We were actually able to start with about 3.5%, 4% maybe. And so we started meeting as a group every week, encouraging each other, talking through the difficulties and the struggles that we were having in disciple making, sharing what's working for you. Okay, maybe I'll try that, or maybe it's not that, but it'll inspire me to go do something else. And so we had, again, about 3.5% of 800 people coming together. And pretty soon that group grew to 40, because we're asking questions every week. Hey, do you know somebody else that we did not identify on the front end that should be a part of this group and part of these conversations? And the group kept growing. And the next thing you knew, we had about 6% of our population, 6% of our adult population in that group, talking disciple-making, trying disciple-making, doing it in different ways. And what I found was so cool in that process, you know, Josh, you talked about never having been discipled yourself. We started to disciple each other within that group as we break out in smaller groups and talk. And week after week, we were discipling each other as we really started to do the work of making disciples who make disciples. And I can tell you now stories that are at least four generations deep, and maybe deeper, because I'm no longer at that church, because it was time for me to go somewhere else and do this again. Okay, so we got to the place where I knew I didn't need to be there. And hopefully, just as Josh says, hopefully four generations down the road, nobody knows my name, because that's not what matters. It's that a new DNA, the right DNA, has been embedded within a group of people who love Jesus, yes, but who needed to see what it really looked like to love others so much that we started making disciples who made disciples who made disciples who made disciples. And that was the moment of transformation for us.
So you tried the dump method, and it didn't work. And you tried the diffuse method of focus on the early adopters, and you created some other type of gathering or meeting for them outside the normal predictable rhythms of whatever your programs were. And so it was truly optional. They opted in, and in their passion, you poured into them. And you saw that begin to multiply. I want to just add one word, and this came when, Josh, you were talking at the hybrid incubator. We were in prayer, and I heard the Lord say, beware premature ultimatums. In my passion, I think I was about to unnecessarily cut off people who can't embrace it yet, because they're just not wired to be early adopters. That's right. And you just said that is a good word, and just capture and share the stories of your people doing it. The stories of Shadonke Johnson in Africa won't work. Josh's stories from India don't work. We need stories of people doing it here. Get those early adopters going, capture their stories, and tell and share, you know, share those stories.
Great stuff from Paul and Josh. I hope you enjoyed the episode. Next week, we continue this discussion on practical next steps by having a panel discussion with three other individuals. You won't want to miss out. Once again, thank you for listening to the Real Life Theology Podcast, where we renew the teachings of Jesus to fuel disciple making. The Real Life Theology Podcast champions all biblical truth, including hard topics, by sharing discussions, webinars, public presentations, and similar resources to fuel disciple making among all nations and ethnic groups. I hope you enjoy the rest of your day, and I will see you next week.